thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Some Democrats in Congress are stepping up efforts to lift a ban on openly gay men and women in the U.S. military. With the U.S. fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they argue the country cannot afford to lose qualified military personnel. But critics say repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell would harm recruiting and retention of military personnel, and ultimately harm national security. Joining me in the studio to discuss the issue, Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Charles Coley Stimson, a former Pentagon official and a trial judge in the Navy JAG Reserve, and Dan Efron, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Before we go to our panel, though, we're joined by phone from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, by Patrick Murphy. He's the Democratic congressman from Pennsylvania's 8th District and an Iraq War veteran. Congressman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Susan, for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, last week, you announced that you would lead an effort to get Congress to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. What would your bill do?
Sure. It will repeal the discriminatory practice, which is in effect right now. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy does not allow gay soldiers to serve openly in the military. And, Susan, the reason why this policy needs to be repealed right away is because it is hurting our national security. We have let go over 13,000 troops. That's over 3.5 combat brigades at a time when our troops are fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we need every qualified and able-bodied individual to serve in our military.
Now, what kind of experiences did you have on this issue when you were serving in Iraq?
Sure. Well, first, when I was in Baghdad as a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne Division, you know, there was obviously gay soldiers, like they all are in America, there was gay soldiers serving with us. And, people knew it, but, you know, they didn't talk about it. And the fact is that our troops, you know, when they're in Baghdad or whether they're in Kabul, Afghanistan, they don't care whether you're gay or straight, what religion you are, what color you are, what creed you are. They care whether or not you can fire an M4 assault rifle, whether or not you can kick down a door. Can you get the job done? That's the important thing, not what your orientation is.
Now, President Obama campaigned last year during the presidential election opposing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So why not have him issue an executive order that would change this policy or lift it?
Sure. Well, first, it was an act of Congress that put this law into place, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and it'll take an act of Congress to repeal it. You know, when I was a Democrat, I've only been in Congress, as you know, Susan, for 2.5 years. You know, I used to have a hard time and used to criticize President Bush when we would pass laws and he would have these executive signing statements that basically would say, I know Congress passed such and such, but we're going to ignore that part of it. That's not having the proper respect for a co-equal branch of government. And what President Obama says is that, listen, he understands we're a co-equal branch of government, and he also understands that it was an act of Congress that put this in place, and it's going to take an act of Congress to repeal it. What President Obama has cleared, he said to his military, to both Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he said, figure out how we're going to implement this thing. And meanwhile, I'm asking the Congress of the United States to pass a law to put it on my desk so I could sign this repeal into law. And that's my job. My job is to quarterback this, and House representatives, as the first Iraq War veteran, led to the Congress, and to get it through the House. We're already up to over 154 signatures of co-sponsors, and that's wonderful progress in the week that I've done it.
Are you disappointed that President Obama hasn't placed a higher priority on this issue during his first 6 months in office?
No, I think, you know, he's, you know, at the first 6 months, he's made it clear a couple weeks ago that, listen, he had to deal with, as the new commander-in-chief, what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was obviously, we're in the worst economy since the Great Depression. We've lost over 6 million jobs. And he didn't say, well, I'm going to talk tackle this after my first 2 years or the next term. He said, no, we're going to deal with this now. Let's get after it. And we need to do our job as a Congress. We can't punt this responsibility to the president. We can't punt this to the courts. We need to tackle this. Even though it's a controversial issue for some, to me it's not. And in fact, to most Americans, the overwhelming majority of them support a repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. But we have to get after it. And it's not even just, Susan, the public opinion and Americans out there. It's also the top folks in the military. And people like General Colin Powell, who's one of the co-authors of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy back in 1993, he himself has just come out and said, we need to reevaluate this. And change it. You know, folks such as the superintendent, Admiral Larson of the U.S. Naval Academy, says that we need to, you know, change this policy. So, you know, and listen, I know my brothers and sisters in arms who I serve with, both as a West Point professor and as someone who served two deployments after 9/11. I could tell you that our troops don't care about whether or not what orientation someone is. They just care whether or not you can get the job done.
Now, you, lots of members of Congress introduce bills, but it's up to the leadership which ones get to move forward, be considered and debated. What is your sense from the Democratic congressional leaders about whether and when they might allow your bill to move forward?
Sure. Well, my goal as I quarterback this is that when it comes up for a vote, and it's going to come up for a vote, that we need to make sure it gets passed. And, you know, I took this over from Secretary Tauscher, who's now one of the undersecretaries of state. And now we're working our way through the Congress. We need 218 folks to vote on this. You know, we have 154 co-sponsors, but we, you know, need 218 votes. So there's a lot of folks that said to me, you know, hey, Patrick, I'm going to vote for it when it comes up for a vote, but I just don't feel comfortable, you know, being a co-sponsor. You know, but, you know, we're still working on those. And listen, we're working on both sides of the aisle. I'm not just going to Democrats. I'm also going to Republicans. We have one Republican right now, but we need more. And we need folks to call their congressmen. This is how change is not easy. Change just doesn't happen because it's the right thing to do. We need to put the political pressure on those, you know, who are still for a discriminatory practice to change it and to say that we have a non-discrimination policy in the United States of America Armed Forces. And I tell you, it's the right thing to do, especially when you look at there's 24 other nations that allow their troops to serve openly. Even our strongest allies like Great Britain and Israel and Australia, I mean, these are folks that are in the fight with us, and they've had no problems whatsoever. So, you know, to those who criticize, you know, our efforts, you know, to repeal this, no, I have a question for them, Susan. It's, why don't you think the American soldier is as professional as all those other soldiers in other countries? We have the best military in the world. We are very blessed for the young heroes that serve our country.
Okay.
You know, let's have full faith and confidence in them.
Congressman Murphy, thank you so much for being with us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks, Susan. I appreciate the time.
That was Congressman Patrick Murphy. He is from Pennsylvania's 8th District. He joined us by phone from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and he is a veteran of the Iraq War. Well, Coley Stimson, let me ask you, the congressman said that this isn't something that the president could do by executive order, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It needs congressional action. Is that your view?
I think that is the appropriate view. I think the congressman laid out the reasoning why. The White House counsel's office, as I understand it, agrees with the congressman that only an act of Congress can be repealed by an act of Congress. You heard recently Secretary Gates, the head of the Defense Department, say that he's going to look at ways to implement the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy more humanely. But that's not going to be enough for an outright repeal. And so I think that's an interim step. And it's clear that the vast majority of Americans, like the congressman said, are in favor of a repeal. But the polls, the internal polling that Gallup and others did with respect to polling the military, they're more evenly split. And so I think that's why you see this president taking his time and getting the best military advice he can from the chairman and other senior leaders.
Well, Julian Barnes, are there ways the administration could stop enforcement of the law, even if Congress hadn't overturned it?
It looks like they can't. I mean, it looked like people within the Defense Department, people within the White House look to say, hey, could we use stop loss or something else? But the answer is no.
Using stop loss would be what?
Stop loss allows the military to hold someone in service beyond the term of their enlistment. It's been used to keep units in people in Iraq longer. And so some had suggested, could you do this to keep gay servicemen in the service? But the answer seems to be no.
And Dan Efron, what kind of reaction do you think the White House has had to the effort by Congressman Murphy to push this effort forward legislatively?
Well, I think I think President Obama wants to see this thing passed, but I think he wants to go slow, and at this stage he doesn't want to be proactive about it. So having someone in Congress take it over and quarterback it, as Congressman Murphy describes it, is probably something that the White House supports. The question is, at what stage does the White House become proactive about getting it passed? And that's probably what will be required ultimately for this repeal to go through.
Well, the White House has a lot of things on its plate at the moment. We've got the Sotomayor hearing starting this morning. We've got health care at a critical point. What's your sense when the White House would be prepared to make this a priority?
Not soon, not in the coming weeks or months. I think one of the things that they keep in mind, one of the things that gay rights groups talk about a good deal, is the midterm elections. The Democrats have a majority in both houses of Congress. You want to act before the midterm elections, before the Dems lose that majority, and probably even earlier than that, because once you get into the election cycle, it becomes harder and harder for people who are running for re-election to take stands on anything that's even slightly controversial.
Yeah, Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, suggested that this action would be taken sometime during the first term, which, of course, is a slower timetable than many advocates of the repeal had hoped for during last year's campaign. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about what's happening with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And we'll take your questions, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking this hour about the issue of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And joining me in the studio, Dan Efron, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Newsweek. Charles Cully Stimson, he's at the Heritage Foundation. He's a former Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary for Detainee Affairs, and he works as a Navy JAG officer. And Julian Barnes, he's a Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. So what are the arguments, Cully Stimson, for keeping Don't Ask, Don't Tell as policy?
The arguments are that everyone in the military knows that gays have served honorably in the military throughout history. People like me and others who have served in the military know that we've served honorably, served with gay people. We know them. They're our friends. They're our colleagues. They're our shipmates. But in a time of war, social change, which is what we're talking about, of this magnitude should be taken slowly, and the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is, quote-unquote, working for now, and that we should get the best military advice we can from the senior leadership in uniform in the building before we engage in a massive change.
So, Julian Barnes, what are the arguments for lifting the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy?
Well, as Congressman Murphy said, they've had 13,000 soldiers and airmen and sailors pushed out of the service. The advocates for change frequently cite the number of Arabic speakers who have been pushed out, people who are in critical areas that the military can't afford to lose. And they argue that these people are good soldiers, they are serving well, why are they being pushed out for a discriminatory policy? That's the argument that people make to say this is an antiquated policy that needs to go.
You know, it was in 1993 that Congress passed this law, and it was enormously controversial. Any of us who were around in Washington remember what a fierce battle that reflected. Dan, what's happened since then with attitudes toward this issue among the American public?
Well, if you think of 1993, it was this era before Will and Grace, largely before the internet, really. And there's been a tremendous change socially in the country over the years. I think the polls, when people outside the military are asked about don't ask, don't tell, or about gays serving openly in the military, in 1993, at that period, it was less than half the country. When you ask people that today, it's much higher. It's more like 70 or 75% who say, this is fine. This is a different country, different attitudes, and gays can serve openly just fine.
We have an email from Carrie in Cincinnati who's asking, what about generational differences when it comes to attitudes on this issue? Julian, is there a big generation divide?
There is within the military. If you talk to older officers, senior generals, I've had private conversations with them, and they have said, they raised the same issue that was raised in the early 90s, unit cohesion. How in the midst of two wars can we force this change on a very diverse group of young soldiers and Marines who have very different opinions? And you'll all of a sudden introduce romance into combat units. It would be the equivalent of pushing women into combat. That's what the older generation of senior officers, some of them, will say. Now, younger officers, almost uniformly, this is a policy that needs to change. They are much more comfortable with gay people. They have known gay people all their life. Within the enlisted ranks, it's a little bit different, a little bit about where in the country you're from. There are people who very young Marines from the South may have a slightly different view than the slightly older soldier who comes from the Pacific Northwest or the Northeastern United States. And, depending on how many people are in a unit, the vibe is a little different.
Coley, have you seen a big generational divide within the military on this issue?
I have. I remember when I first got into the military and actually interviewed to be an officer, and I interviewed with the Marine Corps and the Navy. And the Marine Corps recruiter, first thing he said to me, Susan, is, so, are you gay? This is in 92. And I said, no, are you? And that was the end of that part of the discussion. I've defended people who have been processed out for being gay, for having homosexual proclivities or taking homosexual acts, and then I've prosecuted people for violating the UCMJ, our Uniform Code of Military Justice, our penal code, who were homosexual. I think Julian is right. I wouldn't want to paint with a broad brush and say all the old geezers like me who are 46 who are senior officers are all against it, and I wouldn't want to say all junior enlisted are for it, but there is a generational rift, pretty much, and I've talked to several senior officers, flag and general officers, and then some special forces guys in anticipation of this interview, and all of them, to a number, told me, you know what, if the law changes, we'll learn to live with it, which I thought was interesting because, special forces guys are out there way at the pointy end of the spear, living in close quarters, and if they can say that, that's a significant thing.
Well, why then, if the general public doesn't have a problem with it, and if increasingly at least the younger members of the military don't have a problem, why, Dan, does this continue to be so controversial in Congress? Congressman Murphy talked about the fact that while he has about 150 co-sponsors, that's not nearly enough to get it passed. That's not most of the Democrats in Congress. Why is it still controversial?
Look, I would say two things. One is that we're engaged in two wars, and there's always a concern that any shift during a time of war and very complicated wars, you don't do that. You don't mess with things because you don't know how it'll impact the military. I think the other thing is that I think that the ghost of 1993 is still knocking around the White House. And by that I mean that, you know, when President Clinton went in and tried to do away with the ban altogether of gays in the military, he came up against, he did it, I would say, rapidly. He came up against a lot of opposition at the Joint Chiefs, at the military, the top echelon of the officers, that echelon that Julian was talking about. And he paid a price for it in terms of his relationship with the Joint Chiefs for a good long time. And so I think even when President Obama talked about during the campaign repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the idea of doing it quickly and doing it wrong is anathema, and it's a big concern for the White House.
All right. We've got a lot of callers with interesting points of view. Let's go first to Tara. She's calling us from Michigan. Hi, Tara.
Hi.
You're on the air. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. I have actually a comment. It's interesting you mentioned special forces. My partner has worked in the military, in the Army. She's now in the reserves, but she was in the auxiliary to the special forces. During that time, she was awarded a Bronze Star, two Purple Hearts, and several conduct and service awards. And she is currently under investigation for homosexual conduct. And she is being threatened being kicked out. And they've also threatened her with a general discharge with honorary conditions. And all this is simply because she is a lesbian. And she never came out and said, I am a lesbian. Someone reported her because we happened to be together and honestly we're riding a horse together. And because just due to the circumstances. So a neighbor reported to her superior officer, and since then she's been under investigation.
Well, that must be very distressing for her.
It's extraordinarily distressing. And on top of that, it's like I've talked to many people, and the general population does not realize that you can be discharged due to this. I mean, everyone I've talked to, straight or gay, has basically said, you've got to be kidding. I didn't think this could exist. Mm. So there's an impression in the general population that this is not a problem because Don't Ask, Don't Tell exists.
All right, Tara, thanks so much for your call. Now, Kelly Stimson, is this a common occurrence where somebody, some third party reports it, sees a couple together and reports it, and that's what puts this to be an issue in someone's continued service?
Let's make sure that we know what Don't Ask, Don't Tell requires and what it doesn't say. First off, it does not say you have to prosecute somebody criminally for any act, riding a horse with a same gender person. That's not a crime, thank goodness. But Don't Ask, Don't Tell requires that a member of the armed service be separated or processed a hiring decision from the service if it's found that the member has either one, engaged in, attempted to engage in, or solicited another to engage in a homosexual act or act. Two, stated that he or she is a homosexual or bisexual. I guess lesbian would be included. And three, married or attempted to marry a person known to be of the same biological sex. So in Tara's situation, where her same-sex partner is in the military, it sounds, based on those facts, two people, same gender, riding a horse, that's not going to be enough. There may be an investigation. The command has a discretion, I think, to not order the investigation in this case. It, clearly, from what Tara says, they are. It doesn't sound like there's a lot of there in this one. Now, Tara is saying that maybe Tara is a fake name, that they do have a relationship, so they have a relationship. But I would think a lot of the JAGs who are my colleagues in any of the services advising the command would say, look, there's just not enough there, drop it.
Well, what if someone reported this? Oh, I saw them riding a horse together, and they go to the person in the military and say, are you involved in a same-sex relationship? And the person said yes. Would that be enough to process them out of the military?
Yes, it would. And in fact, I've defended somebody under those circumstances. And typically what happens is they go before an administrative discharge board. The government council lays out the facts. And a good number of those 13,000 troopers who have been let go that Congressman Murphy talked about, actually self-reported. They said, look, I'm homosexual, I'm lesbian. And so it is incorrect to say they were booted out. I can see why they feel that way, but a lot of them knew what the policy was and sometimes use it to get out of the military to avoid deployment. So that does happen. So we have to be clear about what happens here. They are out, and they are forced out, but some take advantage of the policy to get out to avoid deployment, and that does happen.
Although that does not seem to be the case.
Not here at all. No, and I would think no JAG I know, and I know a lot, having taught at the Justice School in Newport for years, would recommend to a commander that there's anything there when two people are riding a horse.
All right. Tara, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am.
And so anything you'd like to add given the discussion we just had?
No, I just think one of the main, well, actually, yes, the only other factor is I do think that it needs to be more publicized of what the Don't Ask, Don't Tell actually means for people. Because, like I said, the public is not aware that people can be kicked out for this conduct, and whether it's conduct or whether it's just an impression. So I just think getting that information out would be really important.
All right, Tara, thank you so much for your call. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's take another caller. We'll go to Bill. He's calling us from Fort Myers, Florida. Hi, Bill.
Yes. I served in the Army for 25 years, and I was a paratrooper like the congressman in the 82nd Airborne. I was in the infantry, and I want to say that I disagree with his comments that it affects our national security. What it does affect is unit readiness, because I knew a platoon sergeant. Unit was being deployed to the Sinai, and some of his soldiers thought that he might have been, was a bit funny, but he wasn't gay. They weren't sure. So when the unit was being deployed, a lot of the soldiers did not want to go with the company and that platoon. So a lot of them find excuses to get transferred to Alaska and TCS to all the places. Now, it was after I came back, and I said to myself, what happened here? Why did they all want to leave that platoon? That I sensed that there was something going on because they thought the platoon sergeant might have been gay.
Huh.
So what it does affect is readiness, and a lot of infantry soldiers do not want to serve with someone who might be funny because they feel uncomfortable with it. So that's my main comments there.
And, Bill, what year was this?
I'm sorry?
What year did this happen?
I didn't hear you.
What year, what time period are we talking about?
1995. The battalion, the 82nd, was going to the Sinai,
mm-hmm.
and I was part of that battalion as well.
Oh.
And I see a lot of uncomfortableness, a lot of soldiers. And also, when one of the, when they came back, an entire squad went AWOL because they didn't like what was going on. So that's what I'm saying. It could affect readiness and also affect our national security, but not in the way the congressmen think.
All right, okay. Bill, thank you so much for your call and your perspective. But Julian, what do you think about Bill's experience?
Well, when you hear Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen talk about this when they're addressing service members, I think they are basically saying two things. One, they're telling service members the commander-in-chief wants a change in this. It is going to happen. Prepare for change. And then two, they say, we're not going to do anything fast. A few months ago, Secretary Gates raised the timetable of integration of the armed forces, says it took 5 years to integrate blacks into combat units. And he said, well, we're not necessarily talking 5 years here, but we took it slow then. We're going to take this slow. We're not going to rush anything. And that is their theme. They've come back to it time and time again in the recent weeks of going slow, trying to not force a quick cultural change, but make sure that they lay the groundwork, that they prepare people. However, you know, from 1995 till today is a fairly long period of time. I think that in many units, you'd find a very different attitude today than you would have more than a decade ago.
Dan, do you see parallels with the military's experience in integrating the armed forces?
In Truman's time, integrating
yes.
African-Americans?
Exactly.
I think certainly people, yeah, I think it's hard not to see the parallels. I think Truman was very cautious. He talked about this five-year period, but he also was very firm about it. He said, this is going to happen. And there was pushback from the top echelon of the officers. He said, look, I understand what you're saying. I want to hear you out, but this is going to happen. It's going to happen slowly, gradually. I would not be surprised if the Obama administration and people in the administration are looking very closely at the way President Truman went about doing it.
And, of course, the military's integration, racial integration, is something that is now a model for the country. But how long did it take to work out the problems that people warned about when Truman moved toward integration? Were there problems for a long time or not so?
I would just say that some of the things that people who are opposed to repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell Some of the things they cite are the very things that were cited 50 or 60 years ago with the integration of African Americans. And primarily, and we didn't get much into this, but the idea of recruitment and retention. You hear people today talking about this idea that the recruitment comes often from areas that are more conservative parts of the country, and that parents don't want to send, wouldn't want to send their children to the military if they view it as a more liberal body that allows gays to serve openly. I think this is the kinds of arguments, these recruitment and retention, unit cohesion that were made in the 40s and 50s with the integration of African Americans, and were worked through over time.
We're going to take a very short break. When you come back, we'll continue our conversation about the issues of don't ask, don't tell. And we'll continue to talk with people on our panel, and we'll take your calls, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org, by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sunlight is one of the Earth's most abundant and accessible sources of energy. But solar power is currently being used to meet only a tiny fraction of America's energy needs. The technical, financial, and political challenges facing the U.S. solar power industry. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about the question of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell for the U.S. military. And with me in the studio, Cully Stimson. He's a former Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary, and he's a Navy JAG officer. And Julian Barnes, a Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And Dan Efron, he's the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. Here's a question from an emailer, Rick. He says, why is it that other countries can have gays serve openly and yet we have such a difficult time with this issue? And how do our troops deal with other countries' gay troops fighting next to us in the trenches? Julian, what would you say to Rick?
The reality right now is, as Cully mentioned earlier, I think in many units today, there are gay people serving. They're just not open. But, you know, as many units, they know that that person is gay, or many people do. And so, therefore, there's little difference if they were in a trenches with a British unit where someone's allowed to be open. They're, in that unit, in that British unit or another country's unit, they're not going to probably be discussing it a lot unless you're just sort of joking around as infantry guys do. So I think that issue is in reality is not going to be a real obstacle. But time and time again, it is the sort of the fear that, as the earlier caller said, that there would be some sort of divisiveness in the unit is what people who are opposed to it bring up and say, we can't undermine the effectiveness of our fighting. So that's the crucial issue at the center of it.
Now, 24 other nations allow gays to serve openly in their armed forces. What's their experience, Dan? Do they have problems? And why is it a bigger issue here than it is in those other countries?
Well, look, I don't know that it would be a bigger issue here than it is in Israel, for instance. Israel's a good example because it's a military that isn't, you know, isn't just a military, a garrison military. It actually sees combat on a regular basis. And there was a switch. I don't know. I think it was about 20 years ago, and it was very smooth. I don't know that there's an expectation here that a transition wouldn't be just as smooth, and I know that people in the military do look at the British example, the Canadian model, the Israeli model, and study that. And the idea is to look at it if there will be a transition here to try to replicate the good things that happened elsewhere.
Coley Simpson, what do you think?
I think just as financial markets factor in an interest rate cut before it happens, the military, especially junior folks and younger officers, have already factored in the fact that it's changed in their lives because they know gay people who serve around them all the time. I mean, I've been in many command functions in the 17 years that I've been in the military where a friend brings their same gender friend. And everyone knows what's going on and no one really cares. Now, I will say this, though, that the closer the quarters, the closer you have to be to your fellow human being in a combat situation, in a foxhole somewhere, I think the more the sensitivity rises. And so I think, you know, you probably have emails from Marines or others who would say, look, come on, sexual relations shouldn't exist in the foxhole between men and women, and it shouldn't exist between men and men or women and women. They should be focused on fighting. And so they're worried, I think, that the close quarter combat situation and I think some folks are going to feel uncomfortable. There's no doubt about it. But I think this change will take time, but I think it's inevitable.
Now, Rick is calling us from Herndon, Virginia, and I see that he served, I believe, on a Navy vessel during the Vietnam War. Is that right, Rick?
That's correct. I was on a guided missile frigate, served outside Haiphong Harbor. We called it PIRAS. It's basically was a radar picket ship. Mm-hmm. And our division had approximately 30 people in it, and they worked in CIC. And we had a first-class petty officer. How many people knew he was gay, I don't know. I was 19 at the time, and you talk about close living quarters. You can't get much closer living quarters than on a naval vessel that's on station for approximately 90 days. He was an outstanding sailor. There was never any problems. And I just figured it was his business, and I never discussed it, and I don't know that anybody did.
Well, that's interesting. So your view now would be that there's no need to have this don't ask, don't tell policy?
I believe it's going to be done away with in the future. It'll be the same situation that they have when they first started putting female sailors on ship. And, you know, if people are going to do it, they'll be inventive. But in this day and age, I just can't see the sense of it.
Well, Rick, thanks very much for your call. Now, Rick mentioned the issue of women in the military and perhaps some parallels with that. We've got Dora calling us from Ashway, Rhode Island. Now, Dora, you served in the Army, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I served in the Army for 23 years. I retired as a first sergeant. And in fact, my last unit that I was assigned to was with the Military Intelligence Company with 7th Special Forces Group out of Fort Bragg.
Yes, and so what would your view of this issue be?
Well, my view, after listening to all these numerous comments and through my own personal experiences, many of the arguments are very similar to what has been stated throughout the years regarding the integration of minorities, be it male minorities or women, into the military. And I just truly believe that we're at a time now that we need to fully accept people regardless of what their preferences are. And if they are capable of performing their mission, then more power to them and allow them into the military to serve their country.
All right. Well, Dora, thank you very much for your call.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Let's go to Terry. Terry's calling us from Richmond. Is it Richmond, Indiana, Terry?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question was that I'm 52 years old, and I missed the Vietnam draft by 2 months, so I've never served military. So my question was that I think that a vote towards homosexuality or anything to do with military personnel should be done strictly within the military. So in other words, the voters on it should just be past and present military personnel, because it's a system of life that I haven't, you know, I don't even know if they, if military troops shower co-ed or separate for male and female. I mean, that's just how naive I am on military life. But the same consequences with homosexuality. I'm, you know, the common person out here who's never served, I don't think would really voice an opinion that would really be substantial to the problems that it that could exist with that situation.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Terry. Well, Coley Stimson, tell us a little about military life.
Well, men and women don't shower together. That's not a policy. I'm sure some have, but it's not common practice that commands put a rubber stamp on. It depends on the kind of unit you serve in. I mean, JAGs, for instance, doctors, you know, they live out in town in their apartment in a civilian quarters. Combat troops, especially junior enlisted folks, live in barracks on post or station, usually on ship. And there is something more tight quarters than a ship in a harbor, and it's a submarine where men serve, and they quote-unquote hot rack. There's, let's say, 100 beds, and there's 200 guys there, and one guy gets off the rack, and the other guy gets back on, and the guy who gets off the rack goes on to duty. So that's even closer quarters than a ship sometimes. Marines are in close quarters, especially when they're deployed. Army, especially ground forces and infantry, artillery are in close quarters, especially when they're out in the forward operating bases in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it depends. There's no universal way it's done. Back in the United States, a lot of officers, most officers, live off post out in town.
Well, we know that under this the current policy, you can't openly be gay. Talk about what kind of behavior are we talking about being openly gay that would get you into trouble, and how does that compare with the heterosexuals in the military?
Yeah, and this is exactly the kind of discussion that needs to take place in front of the American people by congressmen. We need to have an open, frank discussion about this. We need to listen to uniformed officers, enlisted, senior enlisted, junior enlisted. It is inappropriate and against regulation for a man and a woman in uniform to hold hands or have any public display of affection. Two sailors, male and female, who are dating, cannot kiss, hold hands, hug in uniform. Now, they can give each other a peck on the cheek when they're saying goodbye. They can shake hands. They can give a hug of support. But you can't have a lover's type situation when people are in uniform. And so heterosexuals can't, quote unquote, serve openly in that sense. But I think what gay activists want is simply to be treated the same way heterosexuals are. And that is, when you go to command functions, you can bring your significant other or spouse, and they don't want to be prosecuted for sodomy, which is a crime under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or indecent acts. Potentially, you could be prosecuted for indecent acts. Almost all indecent acts and sodomy prosecutions are heterosexuals. And sodomy includes oral copulation, oral sex, for the most part. So I think that's the way I would answer it, yeah.
You know, Terry suggested that the vote should be only in the military, only of the military. What do you think about that, Julian?
Well, my first reaction was the military is not a democracy. The military is a hierarchy. They take their orders from the commander-in-chief on down. And that is what you hear senior leaders say, that if there is an order, you know, to change it, if the law changes, they will follow it. And they are reminding troops that that is how it's
how it's going to be, that there will be a change and they will follow it. And you know, the military is at times a conservative institution, and sometimes you need civilian leadership to initiate change, or it does not happen. And so that's why it's impractical to say, let's forget Congress voting, let's just have the military vote. That's not how it works.
If you had a military vote on it, Dan, how do you think it would come out?
A very controversial question, in part because it's difficult to poll the opinions of military people. Occasionally, someone will come out with a poll that'll suggest one thing or another, and then any of us journalists who have written about gays in the military will cite it and then get in trouble from people on the other side. There was a poll by Military Times that suggested that there were more people in the military opposed to repealing than supportive of it. I think there were kind of sufficient doubts raised about how inclusive that poll was. It's very difficult to gauge or to poll opinions in the military, and so we probably just don't know.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Vita, who says, I have good friends who are partners. During the inauguration of President Obama, it was a bittersweet moment for them. While one was able to attend the inauguration, where he really wanted to be was saying goodbye to his spouse who was being shipped off to Iraq. But he wasn't allowed since, per the military definition, they weren't recognized as family. And I wonder, this raises a question of, if you lifted the ban on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, would it affect other policies in the military regarding who is recognized as family, who can have benefits as family? Would it have repercussions for that, do you think?
I think this needs to be part of the discussion. I mean, first and foremost, I'm disturbed by the person who just emailed you that they couldn't say goodbye to their loved one. I mean, maybe they just weren't allowed on post because they weren't a family member. That might have been it. But yeah, there's the separate and distinct question of whether somebody could be recognized as a dependent, subject to all allowances that a dependent would get, like basic allowance for housing, basic allowance for quarter. Would you be put on the Tricare? Would you be put on the DEERS? Would you get health benefits? And then there'd have to be a serious and long look at the fraternization rules and whether that would impact the fraternization rules and the collateral rules like that. So I think the president is wise to listen to the senior leadership. I do think that you can poll the military effectively if you use the undersecretary for personnel and send out anonymous ballots to everyone in the military and require them to fill it out. There are a lot of different ways you could do it. I'm sure there would be controversy around that or any other way of trying to poll the military. But I think first and foremost, you have to look at the collateral things you're talking about.
Let's go back to the phones, talk to Matthew. Matthew's calling us from South Bend. Matthew, thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Yeah, my question and my comment is I'm actually a two-time Iraq veteran, and I'm also a master sergeant in the U.S. Army and a reserve unit in South Bend, Indiana. We had a first sergeant that we all knew was gay. And him leading us in combat was never a problem with myself or any of the other staff or the command. I know one of the people on the show actually made a comment about infantry soldiers. I don't think it's a big enough issue to most of them, the close quarters thing and the showers and stuff like that, although that does pose a problem. But I think mainly it has more to deal with, do we trust the person that we're with? And I think that's really the biggest thing. Do we feel that this person is actually acting in the best interest of the unit, or in the best interest of themselves? And that's a question I think should be raised mainly, and I don't think it's been touched on so far.
Well, that's interesting. And the sergeant that you were talking about in Iraq, that was just kind of a general policy of following the don't ask, don't tell approach?
Pretty much. We all knew it. Again, being a reserve unit, most people, we don't live in barracks. We don't live on base. Most people knew it. A lot of people knew him and his civilian life. And we all just chose to ignore it. We all chose to kind of not really even concern ourselves with it. It didn't involve us, and it really didn't bother us.
Yeah. Well, Matthew, thank you very much for your call, and thank you for your service. Well, let me ask, what's the next step on this? What's going to happen next, Dan?
Well, we spoke to Patrick Murphy at the top of the hour. He's going to go around trying to get more supporters for the bill for 1283. I think there are two things that have to happen in order for this to pass. One is that he has to get the conservative Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, on board. And that means in the House, people like Ike Skelton, Armed Services Committee. In the Senate, people like Jim Webb, military experience, a lot of credibility. But that's just the first thing. The other thing is that, you know, President Obama's position on this, or posture on this, has been, once Congress puts this together, I will sign it. To get it to pass, he really has to send people down to engage in that legislative process. And he's got his chief of staff, who knows something about getting bills passed. I think for this one to pass, he has to get involved.
Dan Efron with Newsweek, Charles Stimson with the Heritage Foundation, and Julian Barnes with the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for being with us this hour of the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.